Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Rules to win by, the power and participation in union negotiations. On the show today, how to fight incredible odds in workplace organizing and the sad state of child labor in America. Welcome to the Thursday, March 7th edition of America's Workforce, where we're available on at least five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with a newcomer by the name of Abby Lawler. Abby is an organizer and labor lawyer based in Seattle. She's currently a legal fellow at the Public Rights Project, and she spent 5 years as a strategic researcher with Unite Here, that would be Local 8, where she provided support to hotel and food service workers in Washington as well as Oregon, all fighting to win their own union contracts. During her time at Unite Here, Abby incorporated successful strategies from union negotiations into local policymaking and community benefits campaigns. So she's a fighter, and she is co-author of a new book called Rules to Win By, and she co-authored this book with labor organizer Jane McAlvey. And I'll tell you, we had Jane on the show. It was some years back. She is one heck of a powerful woman, and she emphasizes both in the book. They emphasize that workers can achieve significant wins through collective organizing and strategies, but it's crucial to focus on building worker power. So important. The two discuss the challenges faced by the labor movement, especially the important shift from organizing to contract negotiations, where the choice of negotiators who understand how to build worker power becomes very, very crucial. We talk on the show so many times. Organizing is great. It's great to finally get to a union, but getting that first contract is so darn difficult. Definitely a book to check out. A lot of labor leaders have been talking about it. Rules to Win By, the Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. Abby Lawler will be joining us on the show as our first guest. Later in the show, we're going to get an update from the Child Labor Coalition, stopchildlabor.org. And joining us once again is Reed Mackey. A little background on Reed. He joined the National Consumers League back in March of 2008. And in his work there, he coordinated the activities of the Child Labor Coalition. And the whole idea here is to call attention to what's going on in America. This is an organization that was actually formed back in 1989, and we have seen an uptick in child labor violations. According to a Washington Post report, more than three quarters of child labor violations in the first month of last year were in food service. In January, the Washington Post analyzed Department of Labor data and found a variety of concerning trends regarding child labor. According to the newspaper, overall, child labor violations have more than tripled in the past 10 years, while violations in food service, they went up 6 times. In the past 3 years, 3/4 of the violations in food service were 14 and 15-year-olds working longer or later hours than legally allowed. And recently, the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration cited a poultry company for its role in the death of a 16-year-old boy. This happened last July. OSHA found that the poultry company, Marjack, was directly responsible for the boy's death after he was actually pulled into a machine at a slaughterhouse. I mean, they should not be doing these. And a lot of states are lowering the age because they say they can't find enough workers. So Reed Mackey, on behalf of the Child Labor Commission, do check out their website. A lot of good information there. Stopchildlabor.org. Let me repeat that. Stopchildlabor.org. And sadly, a lot of the penalties, they're just not enough to stop it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Rules to Win By with Abby Lawler. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you could find more at teamster.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at UAW.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. You could find more at ifpte.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, where you could find more at ulagency.org. Let's go out to the West Coast. The Northwest Coast, I should say, the state of Washington. Joining us on our live line today is Abby Lawler, who is a co-author of a wonderful book, Rules to Win By, Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. Abby's got an interesting history, educated at Yale for political science and then her law degree at the University of Berkeley. And she tied up with Jane McAlevey to co-author this book. We're going to talk about the book because it's so important for union organizers to do the right thing. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about on the show today, because labor law isn't pretty. It's not good. We need to update labor law. That's another issue. We're really not going to get into that. But Abby Lawler, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ed. It's great to be with you.
You know, if you would be so kind, every time I bring a new guest to the show, I'd like to get your personal take on how you got to where you are today. And I was reading your bio, very, very impressive. It sounds like you really got involved in unions and organizing at a young age. Take me back to that time. Did your family participate in unions? Let's start there, Abby. Go ahead.
Sure. It's interesting. I actually have quite a bit of union history in my family, but was not something that I personally was aware of until I got more involved in the labor movement and started to hear stories from family members of the union background in my own family. But my grandfather was a teacher, a high school band director, and also a gigging musician. And so he was a member both of his local teachers union and also the local musicians union, and was active at one point. I think served in leadership of the teachers union in Amesbury, Massachusetts, where my dad grew up. And my dad was also a part of the musicians union when he was growing up and playing gigs. And my grandmother worked for a time in a textile mill in Lowell, Massachusetts. I have some kind of textile worker organizing background in my family as well, and now have, you know, family members who are active in a bunch of different unions. But my first involvement, as you mentioned, I went to college at Yale University, which is a company town, the company being Yale, and was able to see that the unions, or one union, Unite Here, that represented janitorial and food service workers there, clerical and technical workers, and also graduate student workers, was really the only force in that town, in the politics of that town, that was holding Yale accountable, was saying, you know, how is it that people are living in poverty in this community where there's a $20 billion institution sitting right in the middle of it and making demands for some of that money to be redistributed? So that was kind of my entry point to the labor movement, seeing that workers and the workers at Yale were really the ones that had an analysis of, okay, what is going wrong here and how do we fix it? And the people really with a plan to organize and fight back and make sure that, you know, in a community with so much wealth, that that wealth was shared and that people were able to have good jobs and raise their families based on the service that they were giving to that institution. So kind of a bit of my backstory and how I got into the movement. But yeah, since then, I've spent many years kind of trying to figure out where exactly I could fit in and most contribute, and that has led me to a career in law and also to working on this project with Jane, which I'm excited to talk more about with you.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. I see you are currently a legal fellow at the Public Rights Project. Can you give us a little background on that that organization?
Sure. And I've actually recently moved on from that job. So I'm now a practicing labor lawyer in Seattle, Washington. But previously spent about a year doing work on labor standards enforcement with Public Rights Project, which is a really amazing organization that helps to encourage city attorneys, prosecutors, state attorney generals to use their power more aggressively to advance the rights of working people, including by more actively enforcing wage and hour laws, other legislation, secure scheduling laws that you know, workers have fought for and organized to get on the books in the first place. They do work kind of following on to that to make sure that those laws are actually being enforced in a robust and effective way.
So a couple of years ago, I guess while you were a student at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, I guess there was a hotel strike. This was in 2018 at the Marriott. And apparently that's where you pretty much ran into Jane. And that had to be interesting. Can you reflect on that briefly before we move on?
Sure. So most of my career in the labor movement was with Unite Here, the hotel and hospitality workers union. And folks may remember in 2018, there was a nationwide strike at dozens of Marriott hotels around the country, including in San Francisco. And so I spent a lot of time on the picket line in San Francisco with hotel workers there, had the opportunity to actually sit in on some of those negotiations, which was my first experience of being in big negotiations where there's a committee of hundreds of workers sitting down with the boss, in this case, sitting across the table from Marriott, and doing the really hard work of negotiating a union contract while thousands of workers were out on the street on strike, you know, creating the power and the conditions for them to win a really amazing and transformative contract. So that was an experience that I had in 2018, kind of immediately before deciding to make this career pivot and to go to law school, which is where I had the opportunity to meet Jane, who is an affiliate of the Berkeley Labor Center. So I was at Berkeley and she was as well. And she had the idea of embarking on a project to more seriously study how unions collectively bargain, what's actually going on at the negotiating table, what that looks like, and to also put forward an argument about how unions could be doing it better and could be using negotiations really as an opportunity to build power, to strengthen their internal organization, and to win really transformative demands at the bargaining table. So I just come off of this experience of seeing big negotiations for the first time, seeing what workers were able to win through a really effective strike, and also by making really forward-looking transformative demands at the table. And so was just so excited to then have the opportunity to work with her to kind of document some of these cases, including the Marriott campaign and several others that she had worked on, and also some that, you know, neither of us had any direct involvement in, but were able to research and learn from and to put that together and out in the world in a way that people could read and engage with and learn from as well.
Abby, I want to pick on that sometime during the show today, and if you don't mind, because it's important for these independent labor unions. They have yet to secure a first contract. They're doing well on organizing. There's a lot of organizing going on right now, but I want to get into that. And, you know, rules to win by, I mean, that's what this is all about. You want to get the end result to be in your favor as a worker. But I want to go back to that time when you were at Yale, and here you're organizing the hotel workers at Marriott. Wasn't that a bit intimidating? I mean, you're very, very young. You're across the table with some very, very powerful people. How did you feel about that? How did you react to that? You're thinking, oh my gosh, how did I get to this point? Can you take me back to that time?
Sure. Well, I'll say just in regard to my time at Yale. So we were engaged in a lot of community and political organizing that I think was trying to sort of replicate some of the power that workers had built through their unions, trying to replicate some of that in the community so that community members would have, the ability to sit down with Yale and negotiate over new development projects or negotiate over the creation of new jobs, new good jobs in the community. And so negotiations were sort of this the thing that was on a bit of a pedestal for me in terms of, okay, you know that you've really built a significant amount of power if you can actually force the boss to sit down with you and engage in negotiations. And so it's sort of this initial test or threshold that you had to meet of, okay, are we well organized enough and militant enough to get them to the table in the first place? And then And then I didn't know a whole lot about what happened next, right? When you actually get them to the table, what does that look like? And how do you negotiate with them to reach an agreement that's going to kind of, in a binding way, then provide over time these things that you've fought for? And so when I continued to get more involved in the labor movement, I think I was really interested in understanding that next step of, okay, what happens when you're actually at the table? And so I think it was a really profound and intimidating moment to actually be in the room for some of those negotiations. I think most of all during the Marriott strike, because, you know, having been on the strike line and seen the tremendous sacrifices that workers were making to win that contract, just knowing what was at stake in that room was, yeah, really, really profound and intimidating. I should say, you know, I myself was not at the table. I was there to support and observe and to learn from the workers who were on the committee and were at the table and, actually engaged in the really hard work of winning that contract. But I think it's, there's a kind of point I want to draw out of your question, which is that I think it is such a profound experience for workers to be in that room and to sit across the table from their boss as equals. And to me, that is, you know, one of, if not the fundamental point of having a union, is that it enables you to sit down, to negotiate, to play an active role in creating the rules, the laws that govern your workplace and your work and, you know, all of the things that stem from that, right? The health insurance that you're going to have access to, the retirement that you'll have access to, your due process rights as a worker. So many things flow from those rules that you're able to play a role in setting for your workplace. And it's a really profound thing to take, you know, one of the sort of most hierarchical, top-down oligarchic spaces in our lives, like the workplace, and to transform that into something, something hopefully resembling a democracy, but just having the opportunity, right, to sit down as equals and to have a say, such a transformative experience, I think, for anyone. And so really one of the key benefits of this approach to negotiations that we advocate for in the book is that you're allowing many, many more workers to actually have that experience of being in the room, sitting down at that table, being put in the shoes of, you know, a decision maker over your work and your life. And so, yeah, I would say that was something I personally experienced in being in negotiations for the first time, but it's also something that we argue for through the book that many more folks should have as a core experience of what it is to be a union member and to be involved in the labor movement.
Amen to that. You're part of a movement, a good movement, I might add. Amy Lawler joining us on our live line today. She is co-author of a book, Rules to Win By, Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. It's the first of its kind negotiations book written by and for workers, not management. I'll tell you, it's getting great reviews. Got a comment here from Sarah Nelson. Sarah is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, which is affiliated with the Communication Workers of America. Sarah said, at a time when union demand is higher than it's been in almost a century, Rules to Win is required reading. This book is armor for the generation of workers poised to gain power worldwide for the working class. I like that. We'll continue the conversation with Abby right after this.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Ironworkers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
Are you an experienced mechanical insulator looking to take your career to the next level? Insulators Local 50 in Central Ohio has steady work for a number of years. Insulators Local 50 offers a total wage and benefits package that can't be beat. It's not just the competitive wages. Local 50 also provides medical, vision, and dental insurance with no paycheck deductions for you and your family. Don't miss out on the chance to secure your future. Join us at Insulators Local 50. Earn great pay and the best benefits. Visit insulators50.com/AWF50 to fill out the online form, and a Local 50 representative will call to begin the process.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at usw.org. America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at liuna.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. And when you get an opportunity, here's what you do. Just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming.
By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org.
Let's go back to Seattle, Washington. Joining us on our live line today is Abby Lawler, co-author of a great book, Rules to Win by Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. Abby, I want to cut to the chase here. Apparently, there's a number of case studies, six altogether, that are chronicled in this book. And this, I guess, is the teachable moment of America's workforce. If you can kind of reflect, let's start off with the Boston hotel workers. I mean, that's a good place to start. You touched on hotel workers in the first segment. But every campaign is a little bit different than another campaign, and you learn a lot from those campaigns, and you try to take what you learn to the other campaigns. So if we can reflect on a few of these in the book, I want people to buy the book. They will buy the book. We could talk about that a little bit later. But let's talk about Boston. Can we start there?
Yes, absolutely. And I should say, just in terms of the structure of the book, we've kind of an introductory chapter where we lay out 20 key elements for high participation negotiations. So that's kind of your quick hit how-to for how to implement some of these negotiating techniques that we're laying out in the book. And then, as you said, six case studies of unions around the country and negotiating campaigns around the country where workers had bigger, more open, more transparent negotiations and were able to win really transformative demands. So I talked a little bit about being in San Francisco for the Unite Here Marriott strike, which again was a nationwide strike, dozens of hotels, thousands of workers around the country. And in the book, we shift over to the other coast and look at what was going on in Boston in 2018 as hotel workers there also organized and struck really successfully. I think one of the key points that we hope comes across in that chapter, kind of in the midst of conversations about labor law reform and about sectoral bargaining systems and different approaches to negotiations that we could implement, if and when we were able to transform labor law in the U.S., we wanted to kind of offer an example of a place where workers were able to achieve a sectoral standard, not because there was any change to labor law, but simply because they built enough power and did enough organizing that they were able to create the conditions to, through a single set of negotiations, then set a standard that covered hotel workers across the city. And so just to dig into that a little bit more, workers were negotiating with Marriott Hotels, which is the largest hotel company in the world. But there were a number of smaller hotel companies in Boston where workers went to their boss and said, you know, we want to throw in with the Marriott workers. We want our contract to be whatever the contract is that is ultimately agreed to with Marriott, and were able to execute Me Too agreements that said, okay, whatever contract is negotiated with Marriott, that's going to be the contract for hotels around the city. And because of that, the Marriott negotiations had huge consequences, not just for workers who were directly employed by Marriott, but also for hotel workers at these other companies around the city. And those workers knew that and took that really seriously, and so stepped up and I think just demonstrated incredible solidarity and support for the Marriott workers. Another kind of key structural piece was that workers from those other hotels, who again were not Marriott employees, were represented at the negotiating table and actually served on the negotiating committee. And so they were there in the Marriott negotiations, participating every step of the way, even though that wasn't their employer, because that contract was ultimately going to cover them as well. And so, you know, I think you see in the amazing contract that workers came away with that this was a really effective strategy in terms of, you know, you're more powerful when you have all of the hotel workers in the city united around a common set of demands, but also that there were kind of important choices that they made in how they structured their negotiating committee and who was in the room for negotiations that enabled them to pull off that strategy. I think also some other takeaways I hope people have from that chapter, right, is the importance of lining up contract expirations so that, you know, all of those workers were coming out of contract at the same time and were able to negotiate together. And again, just thinking strategically about, okay, what company makes the most sense to kind of focus your energy at? And in this case, they chose to go after, you know, the biggest, meanest, richest, most powerful company, knowing that if they could beat Marriott, right, they could, that the rest of the hotels in the city would fall in line, and were ultimately incredibly successful in doing that.
Good study there. Let's jump to nurses. Nurses have been very vigilant, especially during the pandemic. I mean, they were the heroes, and so many people too on the front line, essential workers. You know this all too well, Abby, that they became zeros. They went from heroes to zeros. I mean, they were so essential. They were needed. They were crying for, you know, personal protective gear. They didn't get it. So obviously that kind of started a movement here. And we've seen a couple of, like, you know, short strikes. I know Minnesota nurses, they went on like a 3-day strike. Talk to me about nurses in Massachusetts and Philadelphia. There's a good case study there. Can you reflect on that?
Yeah. And I mean, what you're saying about healthcare work, I think is incredibly important. There's three different chapters in this book that are about nurses and other healthcare workers, Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and then there's also a chapter about German healthcare workers that takes place very directly against the backdrop of the pandemic. But the Massachusetts nurses is the case study that we have in the book where, you know, workers, nurses in that union had kind of a long tradition of practicing open negotiations where any worker could attend negotiation sessions and be present for those. But in the campaign that we feature in the book, in that set of negotiations at a hospital called Bay State Franklin in Franklin County, Massachusetts, nurses made the decision to actually also include community members directly in their negotiations. And so typically in the book, when we talk about open negotiations, we mean negotiations that are open to all of the workers covered by the collective bargaining agreement. We don't necessarily mean open to just anyone who wants to come. But in Massachusetts, in the small town, in that particular context, they decided that they wanted to have the broader community in the negotiating room as well. And so they opened up the room. They had patients coming to negotiations. They had, you know, politicians, members of the press, people who would show up and be present in those sessions. And I think it was both strategically and symbolically really important for nurses in that case, because their key issue in those negotiations was fighting for lower staffing levels, and staffing has been a huge piece of also the crisis and the really terrible working conditions that nurses and other healthcare workers have been experiencing. There just aren't enough people working to provide the level of care that healthcare workers want to be able to provide to their patients, and not enough people working for them to do their own job safely. And so that was the core issue in those negotiations, and having patients and other people who are directly impacted on the kind of care delivery side of the equation by the short staffing was just important to them in being able to sort of fully explain the impact of short staffing. And it was also, I think, an important part of their broader strategy to have public support for them as they went through their negotiations, and to have folks showing up on the picket line for the two strike actions that they held as part of that campaign. And to make sure, you know, this was a rural community. Again, there are not a lot of good paying jobs. And so nurses wanted to kind of make sure that they were bringing the community along with them as they made those demands. And that, you know, one nurse I talked to talked about how she was very nervous going in that, you know, community members might feel like the nurses were greedy or were asking for too much, which I think, you know, we know is not at all the case, but having community members along for the ride and in those negotiations and really understanding what nurses were going through, I think was an important strategic way of them to build that community support, build those relationships, make sure that, you know, the broader community was really invested in and took pride in having good nursing jobs and having a really high level of care at that hospital, which had been, you know, a really central piece of the community for a long time.
We're speaking with Abby Lawler, who is an organizer and a labor lawyer based in Seattle, Washington, also co-author of the book Rules to Win By: Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. Abby, just a couple of minutes left here. And in the book, you offer what they call practical tools and resources for any campaign. Now, I know there's a number of them. Can you just reflect on a couple for our audience? Because as you know, as I said earlier, there's a lot of union organizing going on right now. Some of it successful, some of it, well, they're still struggling. They're still trying to get that first contract. But what's the takeaway here? What would you put at the top of the list right now, Abby?
Yeah, I'll maybe offer two examples from those 20 key elements that we opened the book with. One is sort of an initial first step. This is the thing that I say, you know, should from day one be kind of the first step in building towards higher participation negotiations. And then the other is kind of a practical tool that you can bring to that first day of negotiations that will be really helpful. But I would say the first element to highlight is using your negotiating survey as an organizing tool. I think a lot of unions have a practice of circulating a contract survey before they go into negotiations to figure out, you know, okay, what are the priorities and issues for the next contract? A lot of unions will just kind of release that survey out, maybe get some back, but are not really carefully tracking, okay, who's filled it out, how many people in the bargaining unit have completed the survey, who's actually talking to their coworkers and engaging with them around the survey and the contract. And so what we recommend as kind of the first step in building towards higher participation negotiations is to take that survey process really seriously and as an opportunity to do real organizing and to really be building the organizing structure within the workplace. And so what that means is that you are doing that survey through one-on-one conversations where workers are talking one-on-one with each other as they fill out the survey, and are, you know, not only are you kind of collecting that information that you need to create negotiating proposals, but you are, you know, those workers are building a relationship with one another. They're finding out about each other's issues. And, you know, hopefully they're encouraging each other to become more involved in the organizing effort. So having that one-on-one conversation as part of the bargaining survey process is really important. And then tracking very carefully who has filled out the survey and who's collecting surveys, and setting a benchmark where you need supermajority participation on that survey before you move into later stages of the contract campaign is incredibly important to make sure that you're actually building a level of engagement and involvement and participation that you're going to need to be successful once you actually get to the negotiating table in winning those demands that workers are putting forward through the survey. So that's one thing I would highlight. I'm going to sneak in a second, actually, which wasn't in my initial setup, but is that unions should ratify their bargaining demands. So lots of unions will ratification vote after they have a tentative agreement and once there's already a deal reached at the negotiating table. But we say in the book that it's great to have a vote at the end. You should start with a vote as well before you even go into negotiations so that, you know, workers have signaled, okay, this is the set of demands that I understand and am behind. And then your negotiating committee has, again, a platform that's been ratified by the broader membership that they're bringing into negotiations. And then the third I'll just quickly highlight is we include in the book an image of this, and folks can go online to the Berkeley Labor Center as well and find a copy that they can actually print out and use themselves in their campaigns, which is a tool called Three Rules of the Room. I think a lot of people have some anxiety of, oh, if you have a lot more people in the negotiating room, is that going to be chaotic? Is it going to be hard to get things done? And the rules of the room is a tool that unions have used to just really effectively signal to anyone who's attending negotiations, okay, here are the rules that we've set for ourselves to maintain discipline in negotiations so that, you know, we don't give the boss any easy excuse of, you can't have 100 people in the room because it's slowing things down or it's too noisy or whatever excuse they might throw at it. So the rules are just one poker face. If you're in the room, you don't react in any way to bonkers things that management might say or things that might make you angry. You maintain discipline and calm. The second, and these are rules again for when management is present in the room. The second is that no one speaks unless it's pre-planned, and that communication all goes through the person who's designated to be the lead negotiator. And then the third is that people can pass notes at any time to the lead negotiator and the committee who's at the negotiating table, and can ask at any time for there to be a caucus break so that workers can talk amongst themselves without management present about what's going on. But that's kind of just a really easy tool, a like half sheet flyer that is out there for folks to use that, again, can just signal really quickly, okay, here are the rules that we're all agreeing to for how, you know, we're not going to give the boss any excuse to say that it's unwieldy to have so many people in the negotiating room.
Well, those are some of the rules to win by. If you want to get more, you'll have to purchase the book, which is available on a number of sources, including Amazon. I hate promoting Amazon, but it's definitely there. Rules to Win By: Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. And joining us on our live line today is the co-author, Abby Lawler, along with Jane McAlevey. So definitely check that out. Rules to Win By. We like those rules to win by. Abby, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing and keep in touch with us. I love your energy on this subject, okay?
Thanks so much, Ed. It's great to be with you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Reed Mackey with an update from the Child Labor Coalition.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's L-I-U-N-A.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at cwa-union.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
This portion of the show brought to you by the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers. For more information, please visit bacweb.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation. Let's go to our live line. Welcome back to the show. We talked to him in 2023. Want to get an update on child labor. We saw a lot of bills being introduced in various legislatures last year. And the good news is, with coalitions like the Child Labor Coalition, a lot of those bills just didn't get passed, or they got watered down to some degree, which is certainly good news. A little background on the Child Labor Coalition. It was formed back in November of 1989 as a number of concerned groups mobilized following the Capitol Hill Forum, Exploitation of Children in the Workplace. Reed Mackey is the director of the Child Labor Coalition. He was an active member back in 1994 and 2006, and then he became more involved as the years passed. And I'll tell you, he's been doing a really good job here. The website to go to is stopchildlabor.org. Real simple, stopchildlabor.org. Reed, welcome back to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today. And I recall a really good conversation with you last year on this subject, and I know you've been very, very proactive in a number of states. Why don't you run down 2023? Let's start right there, because there were about, 15, 16 states which got a lot of attention for lowering the age for children to work. And in many cases, we're talking dangerous occupations. So I'll let you pick it up from there. Go ahead.
Yeah, there were some really bad bills out there. Not all of them, as you said, got through completely, at the beginning strength that they had. But like in Iowa, there was a bill that had 23 provisions in it, and 22 of them were bad, that weakened protections for kids, to stuff like allowing them to work in refrigerated coolers, allow them to work in assembly lines, for packaging meat products. Stuff that they can't do now that's dangerous. We have bills in Florida that would let kids work all night long before they go to school. So, like, they could work the graveyard shift, and they could then go to school. Just crazy. These are for 16 and 17-year-olds, who are trying to get through high school. It doesn't make any sense. There's another bill in Florida that would let kids work on roofs. We know that 16 people died in Florida in 2021 working on roofs. So why would you let teenagers do this? It's really dangerous. I actually tried to do it myself when I was a young man. And after a couple of days, I realized I'm going to fall off this roof. So I quit. But, not all kids can do that. If they don't have the resources, they can't just quit. So really, really dangerous stuff happening out there. We really are concerned about the weakening. These protections took a very long time to bring about, and we thought that they were kind of commonly understood to be, helpful in protecting kids, but they've been under attack.
I saw a story posted on your website about the New York Times that spoke with more than 100 child roofers. You're talking about roofers here, and this was in two dozen states, including some
who began at elementary school age. That really took my breath away. I mean, come on. I mean, that's really, really scary. I wasn't able to download the entire story because there was a paywall on that. I don't have a subscription to the New York Times, but maybe you, I would imagine that you delved into that. What can you tell us about what happened there?
Well, you know, the Times has done a series of child labor stories in 2023 that were just phenomenal by a reporter named Hannah Dreyer. They're well worth looking up. And, you know, in one of her recent ones, she found that a 14-year-old working in a poultry plant in the Eastern Shore of Virginia had gotten his arm caught in a conveyor belt. And he was cleaning the plant, and, you know, he shouldn't have been there because it's illegal to work in processing plants when you're a teenager. But his arm got completely mangled, and it's just an example of, like, you know, what kind of bad things can happen. Yeah, she did find, as you said, that she found over 100 kids working in all kinds of dangerous jobs, including roofing. And, you know, it's crazy, you know, in violation of U.S. law. But the problem is we just don't have enough inspectors, you know, to be out there catching all of these violations. And we now know, we saw a lot of kids working in meatpacking. The USDOL found over 100 kids working in meat processing plants. And those kids were working in the graveyard shift. And then trying to go to school. They were cleaning the facilities with caustic chemicals. And, you know, according to the reporting in the Times, these chemicals are so strong that even like a pinprick in your, rubber gloves can cause like severe burns. So it's just like horrendous Dickensian conditions in some of these plants.
Reed, I'm just wondering, has anybody taken a really good look at the kids we're talking about here? Do they come from impoverished families? Do their parents say, hey, you got to go out to work because we're not bringing enough money in? I'm sure there's a lot of stories out there. What have you been able to gather in a lot of the research that's been done here?
Well, so in some of the worst jobs that we're talking about, like the roofing jobs and meat packing, the Hyundai supply chain story, you know, where they found kids working in supplier factories in Alabama. A lot of those kids seem to be unaccompanied minors, you know, kids that come across the border and they are without family, close family members often, and they're desperate for work. They don't have any idea that these jobs are illegal, I think. And, you know, they take the jobs they're just so vulnerable, you know. They have, and if, you know, if they're being mistreated, they don't know who to call. They don't know who to talk to. You know, they're not members of a union. They have no protection at all.
Mm-hmm. That's really sad. Now, you referenced some of the companies here that did get caught, and there's a lot going on. They're not even close to being caught right now, sadly. But the ones that do get caught for hiring, or in some cases exploiting, I think that's a better word, these children, what are the penalties here? It sounds like it's not enough.
Yeah, that is one of the major problems here. The fines right now are quite low considering the resources of these companies. The firm, the staffing cleaning company that hired over 100 children to work in 13 meatpacking facilities around the country, when they were caught, they were only fined $1.5 million. And it's just not enough. The company makes over $450 million a year in revenues. So it's basically like one day of revenue. And that's just not enough. There are a bunch of bills in Congress that would increase these fines significantly by a factor of 10. So, you know, that's enough, I think, to maybe get their notice a bit more. Mm-hmm. So we're supporting a lot of those bills.
They probably feel it's a cost of doing business if the fine is that low, right?
They might. You know, they are, when these stories break, there is like a huge reputational hit, I think, for these companies. And, you know, PSSI, I think they realized that their whole business model was in danger. And, you know, one of the solutions that they started gravitating towards was unionizing the workers. And that's exactly the solution that we wanted, you know.
Right.
We want these jobs to be union jobs. You know, where unions exist, there's no child labor, you know, because everybody in the union is, you know, it's kind of like a watchdog.
Right.
And, you know, things get reported. So.
Well, let's give some credit to unions for trying to do the best to end child labor. I mean, we're going back well over 100 years here, because when you think back into like the 1830s, 1840s, 50s, that time, I mean, there was all kids working. And that came to an end because of the emergence of unions. Let's get back to the fines here, because I was reading that the Biden administration is looking at a chunk of money here. The last I saw was $100 million, and this would be money that the Labor Department would be used to enforce federal bans on child labor, exploitive child labor. What do we know about that right now, Reed?
Yeah, well, that's we think that is a really important piece of the solution here. The $100 million, about half of that would go to hiring enforcement agents. You know, the DOL only has has less than 800 inspectors for the entire country. You know, when you look at 50 states, that's just not enough. We think that that number needs to be doubled in the next 5 years. And, it's just a question of, you know, more resources. The other $50 million and that $100 million supplemental would go to litigating these cases, because they are very expensive cases to prosecute. And so that $100 million, we think, would really go a long way to stopping some of these abuses that we've been seeing the last year or two.
I'm just wondering how we compare with the world. And I saw this posted on your website. Again, we're speaking with Reed Mackey. Reed is the director of the Child Labor Coalition. StopChildLabor.org is their website, and there's some facts about what's going on in the world. Worldwide, 218 million children between the ages of 5 and 17 are in employment, and 152 million. I mean, that's significant. 152 million of that 218 are, in fact, victims of child labor. Almost half of them, 73 million, work in hazardous child labor. It seems to me that, and now think about the status of corporations today. They're pretty much global, you know, these big companies. It seems like, well, if we can do it in other countries, we can do it in the United States. Do you feel that that's part of their MO going forward?
It's hard to say how much of this is an intentional strategy by the big companies. You know, they claim that it wasn't intentional. But, you know, clearly they're not taking the steps to protect their workers. They're not monitoring who's going into these factories. It's really hard to believe that the companies that owned the meatpacking facilities where those kids were working the graveyard shift, it's hard to believe that nobody reported it to management. Yeah. You know, they saw some of these kids look, you know, were 13 years old. They looked really young. You know, their protective equipment they wore was draped over them, you know, very loosely, because they hadn't grown enough to really wear it. So, you know, they've got to do a lot better. Yeah, you're right. The international problem, you know, it's huge. There's about basically 1 in 10 kids is in child labor. And, you know, just for the public, it's a little confusing, but basically, you know, child labor is child work that hurts the kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the Child Labor Coalition, we're not against teens having jobs. We just think that those jobs need to be, you know, limited in the number of hours the kids work so that their education isn't damaged. And they can't be dangerous jobs. You know, the kids need to be protected.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially elementary kids in the roofing industry. No, I mean, we got to draw the line there. Got to draw the line there. That's ridiculous here. One more question before you go, and I appreciate you joining us here on America's Workforce. You are part of the National Consumers League, and I know you joined the Consumers League back in, what was it, March of 2008. How long have you been director of the Child Labor Coalition? And this is a two-part question here. Do you have enough resources there to do your job?
Well, yeah, I've been the director since I started in 2008, but we definitely need more resources. You know, we do try to leverage the resources of our 37 members, organizational members, but you know, we could definitely use some more staff to do this important work.
All right, let's drive everybody to the website, stopchildlabor.org, stopchildlabor.org. Well, Reed, please keep in touch with us, and we'll keep our eye on the legislatures here in this year and beyond, because this is ridiculous stuff, really ridiculous stuff. Take care, my brother, and let's talk down the road, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you.
And that'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Blue-Green Alliance and Andrew Strom on an update regarding independent contracting.
Until then, all of you, have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.